He felt more and more hatred for his father. Pipe's grandfather had been a gangster hustler who sold heroin. Bimbo took up the family business. But after a while he found he could make more money committing robberies than hustling drugs. He and some friends stuck up bus drivers at the rate of 3 or 4 a day. Some weeks he returned to his mother's house in the Kingsbridge section of the Bronx with $4,000 or $5,000 from robberies and selling drugs. His run was short-lived. One of the crew did a robbery on his own, got arrested, and ended up ratting on everyone. 19 years old, Bimbo went to prison on May 30, 1972, to serve a 4-year sentence. His elder brother got 5 years. In the prison yard, he fell in love with weightlifting. He was released in December 1975. Back on the street, a lot had changed in the Bronx. Many youngsters flocked to the brotherhood of street gangs. 70% of all gang members in the Bronx were Puerto Rican. The rest were mostly black. Big Bimbo's old neighborhood, Kingsbridge, now posed dangers for black families. Bimbo and Vincent Call, later known as Mad Dog, joined the Black Spades. Some wore sleeveless, greasy denim jackets in a fashion known as flying cut sleeves. Their backs were emblazoned with gang crests like a coat of arms, the Black Spades, the Savage Skulls, the Young Lords. They were a ragtag collection that mixed the ideology of the Black Panthers with the countercultural attitudes of the Hell's Angels. But the gangs became more violent and sold the same drugs they meant to shield their communities from. Bimbo realized he could make more money with less risk of arrest from loan sharking. He kept it simple. For every $100 he lent, he demanded $200 back. "There ain't a problem if you don't give it back," he would say. "You're just going to get killed." Bimbo paid off the cops on occasion, and they left him alone. His oldest brother became a police officer and once got him out of jail. But when Bimbo got into trouble again with another sibling, the eldest brother abandoned them. Bimbo turned back to drugs and started shooting heroin. He met Pipe's mother and declared that he wanted to have 13 children. They began with Pipe, but as they added more siblings for him in the following years, Bimbo went to jail for possession of a controlled substance in 1984 for 2 to 4 years, and then served more time for violation of parole, a never-ending cycle of prison and release. Pipe's mother stuck with him and gave Pipe more brothers and sisters. On visits back to Soundview, Miss Annette and Big Bimbo nursed a tempestuous but loving relationship. When he once came home drunk and she discovered a letter from another woman in his pocket, she stabbed him in the back with a butcher knife, collapsing his lung. Rushed to the hospital for treatment, he quickly reconciled with her when she came to visit. Here he was again, finally home after another long stretch, and he was determined to straighten out his wayward son. Pipe charged into the bedroom he shared with his brother, tears streaming down his face. He went to the lockbox under his bed that contained his gun.
"What you doing?"
asked Roe.
"I'm a-gonna kill this nigger."
"You're gonna kill Daddy?"
Pipe pulled out the gun, flipped open the cylinder, satisfied himself it was loaded, and regarded Roe.
"Yes," he said.
Pipe had nursed his sisters, put money on the table, helped his mom while his father was away in prison. Who was Bimbo, a stranger to him, to come home and slap him upside the head on the block where he had a reputation to maintain? The brothers argued as Roe tried to talk him out of it.
"I ain't got no father," Pipe said.
15 minutes later, he heard the latch on the door. Pipe caught his father coming through the door first, ahead of his mother, and raised the gun, aiming it at his father's chest.
"If you ever hit me again, I'll kill you," said Pipe.
Pipe's mom jumped in front of her husband, begging him to put the gun down.
"Don't protect him," blustered Pipe. "I'll fucking kill him."
He faced down his father.
"Don't you ever put your hands on me. You ain't no fucking father to me."
Turning to his appalled mother, he demanded, "How he gonna come home after all these years and discipline me?" Back to his father.
"You crazy? You better ask somebody about me. I kill you where you stand, man."
Then Pipe, satisfied his point had been made, fled. Out on the block, B-Love and a few others saw that Pipe was shaking when he rejoined the group. They tried to soothe him. As he was explaining what had happened, he caught their eyes shifting to a spot behind him. B-Love and some of the others reached for their guns. Pipe turned to see his father walking up behind them. Pipe told the crew to stand down. He commanded, "That's still my pops. I can shoot him. You can't." Bimbo asked if he could talk to his son alone. The other boys examined their feet. Pipe said that there was nothing to discuss. Bimbo apologized. Pipe refused to listen. Bimbo continued, "I started talking to your mother. You know, I haven't been here all these years to watch you grow up, to show you how to be a man. You had to learn on your own. So for me to just come and discipline you wasn't right. You don't know me as a father, so I want to apologize, and I want to—" His voice trailed off. Pipe felt his eyes begin to prick with tears. Bimbo finished. "Hopefully we can try to be friends and try to work and build that father and son relationship." "Whatever," Pipe pouted. But his anger subsided. He had almost completely cut himself off from sorrow or regret, but his father's repentance reached him. "Want to smoke a blunt with me?" said Big Bimbo. Pipe cracked up. "I ain't smoking with you. You trying to go back to jail?" Bimbo offered a conciliatory smile. "I'm just trying to be your friend." In the summer of 1992, Pete went in search of an intellectual framework for their way of life. Stacks of books appeared on the floor of his room, including Sun Tzu's Art of War and Niccolò Machiavelli's The Prince, a 16th-century treatise on the cultivation of power, a book Pete carried with him and urged Pipe and the others to read. Pete saw his own life as a work of art, a blank sheet on which he created a flowing narrative. Everything had symbolism and relevance. Every experience was absorbed and interpreted to create his nascent gang manifesto. Pete referenced a Machiavelli passage. "By arming your subjects, you arm yourself. Those who were suspect become loyal, and those who were loyal not only remain so, but are changed from being merely your subjects to being your partisans." Pipe noticed Pistol Pete's growing notoriety for weapons and his emphasis on handing them out to anyone in his inner circle. There were long screeds on the power of deception, the art of feinting to mask one's true intentions. He found a keynote passage in Chapter 17, Cruelty and Compassion, on whether it is better to be loved than feared, or the reverse. For love is secured by a bond of gratitude which men, wretched creatures that they are, break when it is their advantage to do so. But fear is strengthened by a dread of punishment, which is always effective. Soon Pete's plans for all of them were revealed. The past few summers, Pete's cousin Loaf had visited from Los Angeles. This year, 1992, Loaf was dressed all in blue and told Pete that he had become a Crip gang member in L.A. Pete teased Loaf about his blue uniform, but Loaf said L.A.'s gangs wore gang colors and held territory, in contrast to Pete and his crew in the Bronx, who drew their inspiration from debonair mafia dons, and whose main focus was generating large sums of cash while cavalierly attempting to bed as many women as they could. Loaf parried, "Anyway, all you dudes care about is sex and money and murder." Later, standing outside 551, Pete explained to Pipe that the three words perfectly encapsulated their mission. "Sex, money, murder," he said. "Look, you think about it, we get sex because we get money, and we murder anyone who fucks with our money." As Pete saw it, any murders they committed were for economic liberation in a struggle against an unjust system. Pete argued that the U.S. government routinely killed for economic advantage, so what was different about killing to get money in the projects? Pipe, who'd never thought of things in that way, agreed. Pete said the invasion of Iraq in 1991 was about killing to get oil and therefore money. It was part of life, Pete reasoned, how empires were built. Wasn't that how America was founded? The early settlers and the founding fathers established America with brutality, racketeering, and cold-blooded speculation, while slaughtering anyone who thwarted their commercial interests. "We're sex, money, murder now," Pete told them. It was the American dream inverted, a new equivalent of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the modern gold rush that crack offered, Pete and Pipe were prospectors, gunslingers in the urban ravines of New York City, where growing infamy amid whining bullets meant that tomorrow could bring sudden outrageous riches, or just as easily, a swift, violent demise. Pipe ordered some baseball caps with SMM stitched on the back and designed black and gray varsity jackets with SMM emblazoned over the right breast, a small nod to a West Coast gang uniform. Pete developed a slogan. "Sex, I need it. Money, I got to have it. Murder, it's always on my mind." They belted the refrain. Pete added another line. "East side all the time, sex money gonna shine." East side denoted the East Coast. When they assembled on the block, they bellowed out in unison in what they now termed a roll call, like soldiers in an army platoon. Sex, money, murder had been born. 3. Coma. In March 1992, Shug, on an airplane for the first time, grasped his seat's armrest with both hands, a gold ring encrusted with diamonds and a single word, sugar, adorning a finger on his right. Baby had bought Shug the ring 2 months earlier for his 19th birthday. Baby had also just turned 19, and he and a few others from Soundview, all wearing black Ray-Bans, were flying to Daytona, Florida for a few days of celebration. Springfield had been 6 months of pure profit. Baby and Shug had fat rolls of bills in their pockets. Shug's new life was opening up opportunities he had never known existed. Shug was indebted to Baby for taking him on at his lowest point after his release from Spofford. He had had just $20 in his pocket, but Baby had set him on the path to riches. In return, Shug laid his life on the line for Baby almost every week. Anytime anyone owed Baby money, the pair would drive up and Shug would get out and lay down a salvo of bullets before they peeled off. Shug never knew if he hit his targets, and he didn't much care. It was quick, easy work, like the beatdowns he did for Fat Mike in Soundview, except with guns. Baby threw him a few bills each time. While Pete and Pipe were establishing sex, money, murder in Soundview, Shug had veered off to become part of a loose-knit organization known as Baby J's Crew, quite different from what was happening in the Bronx. It suited Shug, who, out from under Pete's fame, could indulge his ego and a largely unchallenged outlaw reputation in the small city of Springfield. Pete and Baby considered themselves rivals, each too proud to accommodate the other. But Baby was scared of Pete and rarely showed his face in Soundview unless he was with Shug. "How the fuck you represent the View and you scared to even come back in your own neighborhood?" Pete said scornfully to Pipe. Meanwhile, Shug had found himself a girlfriend in Springfield. On Halloween, he was throwing eggs at neighborhood kids from the stash house at 85 College Street when he noticed a light-skinned Puerto Rican girl amid the ghouls. She had a sullen allure and bright green eyes. She paused, pouting in anger as she caught him with an egg in his hand, an impish grin on his face. He froze as their eyes met. "Mama, I ain't throwing eggs at you," he joked, issuing peals of hoarse laughter. "You're cute." Shug teased a reluctant smile from her. She said her name was Gina. Over the months that followed, Shug spent $200 a week on her and her infant son. Unlike the mostly impoverished native boys in Springfield, he was ostentatious and profligate. His charm and bantering wit were infectious. At night, when he finished grinding, selling crack, they snuggled up and watched movies. Some nights, though, she noticed that he couldn't sleep. He'd break out in sweats, thrash, and pant. In the morning, he'd mentioned something about a kidnapping in New York. She didn't probe further. Instead, she touched the puckered scar on his scalp and the bullet wounds on his right forearm, and felt the metal fragments inside his flesh. Shug arrived back in Springfield from his Florida vacation, rejuvenated and ready for action. Dressed in calf-length baggy shorts, a .380 in his back pocket, he pulled into a gas station. As he headed in to pay cash before he pumped, a large Puerto Rican man bumped into him.
"Yo, Poppy," snarled Shug, "excuse me."
"I'm not your Poppy," said the man, returning to his car. Shug felt he might have been going for a gun, so he shot him in the leg before driving off.
Shug was growing increasingly volatile and reckless, and because of that he was drawing undue attention. Baby kicked him out of the College Street house, and Shug moved in with Gina and her family on Nursery Street at a small complex called the Liberty Hill Townhouses. The area was perfect for drug dealing because of its proximity to I-291, ideal for white addicts who yearned for the fizz of a cheap cocaine high, but didn't want to linger in a dangerous and remote area to get it. Baby used Shug to open a new market there. To Shug, the little housing development was a miniature Soundview, with the same maze of dark alleyways and cut-throughs that offered a drug dealer escape if rivals or the police came. Black men were not especially welcome, but Shug spoke fluent Spanish, and the towering Puerto Rican who controlled Gina's block, a man named Muscles, realized that it was to his benefit to have Shug and his connections around. It had become routine for Baby to re-up every week in New York. Sometimes Shug rode shotgun. The 3-hour drive each way was the only time he could ever relax. With Baby at the wheel, he tilted the seat back and slept more deeply than he ever could in New York or Springfield. Shug's volcanic temper continued to worsen. He didn't consider the consequences of gun violence and committed himself to any conflict his friends got into, as he had in Soundview, laying the foundation for the killer he would become. Unlike Pipe, who had set out in the drug game with certain personal rules, certainly with respect to bloodshed, Shug prided himself on having no limits. He could always find some reason, no matter how inconsequential, to justify violence. And he was happy to share inside knowledge of the trade. He was out making drug deliveries when he passed a man from a rival crew who had fought Shug's drug associate and friend B.O. in a street brawl. B.O. was a local tough with a reputation for fistfighting who had fallen in with Shug hustling crack. Shug mentored him in the ruthless ways of the Bronx, and the previous New Year's Eve he had taken him into Magazine Park with a few others and put a firearm in his hand for the first time. He showed him how to shoot a gun into the air, and since then B.O. had forsaken his fists to settle disputes, instead using the revolver he now carried. Shug chased their rival, running several stop signs and red lights, and even streaming past the police station on Pearl Street. Shortly afterward, the man split his tire on the curb and came to a stop. Shug jumped out and tried to shoot him in the face. The slide on his gun jammed, so he repeatedly smashed the weapon into the man's face. The man's girlfriend screamed from the car for him to stop. Back on Franklin Street, near the Liberty Hill townhouses where Shug and other dealers hustled, Shug realized that his shirt was soaked with blood.
"I did him dirty, man," he later bragged to B.O.
Shug's assault ignited a major conflict between the two dominant groups of drug dealers in the area. The black gang near Eastern Avenue controlled the turf near where B.O. and his mother lived and shot up their house one night as they dove to the floor amid shattering glass and splintering wood. By turns, euphoric, depressed, and angry, Shug continued to act out. Baby now had to keep reminding him, as he fixated more on trying to murder late payers than simply spraying bullets near them as he had in the past, that his job was only to frighten people into making good on their debts.
"Just scare 'em up," said Baby. "Don't kill them."
Shug took Gina on a drug delivery and shot at a man on a scooter who didn't get out of their way fast enough. When Shug was arrested on drug distribution charges, the crew passed around a brown paper bag for donations to a legal fund. Shug had been taken to the Big House on York Street, the site in 1898 of the last public hanging in Massachusetts. When Gina visited,
The crew sat outside on the road, blasting rap from the car so that the bass streamed through the walls and doorways. Shug would tap his feet in the cell as he listened to the rallying call of the street. On his release, Gina urged him to go back to school, to invest in a laundromat or a car wash like other drug dealers who made the transition into legitimate business. He didn't listen. He blew his money on clothes, nights out, and cars. When he crashed one, he abandoned it and bought a new one. And when he had no wheels, he borrowed cars from crack addicts. When he and Gina had first met, he'd been a tough kid, but he'd had a tenderness, a wounded look that had drawn her to him. She could see the vulnerability of a young boy still frightened by his world, fighting back fear with all the violence and bravado he could muster. Now he was on a rampage. He wore a sneering expression all the time and drew satisfaction from scaring and hurting people. He and Gina watched Scarface over and over again until the video was riddled with flecks from overuse. Gina watched his eyes glaze over when the advertising blimp rose in the sky with the immortal line, "The world is yours." Gina suspected that Shug was doing drugs because he'd sometimes get sudden nosebleeds. At night he rarely slept, though he might doze 3 or 4 hours in the day. Once, while she was in the shower, Shug was cleaning his gun without having checked to make sure it was empty. A bullet tore through the wall, missing her head by inches. Sometimes he returned to New York to rejuvenate. The only place he felt really safe was behind the ramparts of Soundview. Sex Money Murder was fully in control there now, bringing order to the block and protection for any ally of Pistol Pete's. Shug took Gina down to Manhattan, where he bought her a $900 purple leather and suede jacket. Miss Julia bustled around her, cooking her favorite food while suggesting that she get out of Springfield, leave Shug behind, and come live with her in the Bronx. Shug grew increasingly possessive of Gina. He ripped apart her outfits in fits of jealous rage so that she couldn't go out to clubs. She learned to buy three of everything, so when he destroyed one outfit, she had another to wear. Eventually, Gina broke up with him. They got back together briefly when Shug persisted and chased her down, but she knew he was a ticking time bomb. When Gina ended it again, she heard a rumor that Shug had offered another girl $20 to beat her up. Then he came to her house, and when she refused to let him in, he shot up the door. She ran away to Florida to escape. Shug began to date a young woman with a son from a previous relationship, and before long she was pregnant with his child. The news didn't slow him down a bit. The summer of 1992 saw unparalleled gun violence in Springfield. When he first arrived in the city, Shug had grown accustomed to firing pot shots, mostly for effect. Now, though, his victims shot back. The Jamaican crew from Brooklyn, who had already shot Shug once, were making bigger moves all over the city, stealing the local drug dealers' women while sensing an untapped market on the corner of the interstates and hoping to use the murder of one or two local dealers as an example of their growing power, much the way Sex Money Murder had done in Soundview. Sometime around September 1992, Shug and B.O. went up their block to investigate sounds of a scuffle. Shug found a Jamaican hustling out of one of the crack houses, arguing with some local Puerto Ricans. When Shug approached, the Jamaican stood his ground, unfazed by the short New Yorker with a sharp tongue. "Y'all can't tell me how to hustle," he said. "Yo, son, you can't be out here," Shug answered. "Have we got a problem?" Shug turned to Aunt Live, a drug trafficker from Yonkers. "Yo, why don't you punch him in the face?" The Jamaican demanded to know who Shug was. "Sugar Shaft, and this is our block." Aunt Live threw a quick punch, hitting the Jamaican, who backed up out of reach, pulled out a gun and fired. Shug felt a sharp thump in his chest. His lungs caught fire. Shug pulled the .380 and squeezed. Silence. The gun was jammed or empty. Terrified, he threw it down and ran for his life. He made it down a small incline and felt another bullet rip into his right side just above his kidney. Then his body began to shut down. All of his sensations grew fainter, and he felt himself slipping away. He tumbled to the pavement, struggling for every breath. A neighborhood kid skidded his car to a stop. He hauled Shug into the back seat. Shug felt a stabbing pain in his chest, and then the red light of the Mercy Medical Center loomed above him. Hospital staff heaved him onto a gurney. Shug prayed, panicked, and at some point he shit himself. Doctors swarmed around him. His baby mother appeared at some point, looked at the bullet holes in his chest, and burst into tears. Suddenly, a mask was clamped over his face. Hands secured something around his legs, and a doctor asked him to count backward from 50. At 48, his consciousness began to slip, and within minutes, he floated into complete darkness. 4. Pipelines of the Game. Joy flooded Pipe's apartment when his mother returned from the hospital with a new baby. The arrival of Pipe's youngest sister made everyone feel like a family again for the first time in years. Big Bimbo spent his days playing with his new daughter and helping around the house. Both of Pipe's parents had forsworn drugs, and for 3 months, life was as normal and as happy as he could remember. He hustled a little, but largely spent his days playing Skelzies and computer games and enjoying the mood at home. And when a man abandoned 2 pit bull puppies on Cozy Corner, leaving them tied to a lamppost, Pipe took them in. He named them Red and Yayo. Pipe taught them to snarl at the police. He spent his afternoons at the local roller skating rink, where he was free to be a normal teenager. Then one day, after an afternoon on skates flirting with girls, he returned to the block and learned that his mother had been taken to the hospital. She had collapsed after developing a breathing problem. Most of the family had asthma. Asthma rates in the Bronx were 3 times the national average, but Pipe and his mother had it worst. Smoking crack worsened the condition of her lungs. As he waited for news, Pipe quickly took over the family chores. He packed an overnight bag in case he was called to the hospital. Big Bimbo, who had accompanied his mother there, returned home distraught. They sat waiting for news. Sometime in the afternoon the following day, Pipe's father spotted a couple of uniformed police officers heading to the apartment. At first, they thought they might be a warrant squad looking to arrest Pipe for his parole violation. Reflexively, Pipe made for the stairs and the roof, but Big Bimbo told him to wait. Cops seeking parole violators were dressed in plain clothes, but these men in uniform, he reasoned, were not coming to arrest Pipe. Pipe stood behind his father at the front door when they knocked. The policeman asked if he was Annette's husband. When he said that he was, they gave him the news. Annette had passed away in the hospital from cardiac arrest. Big Bimbo collapsed. He refused to accept it. The policeman requested he go to the hospital to identify the body when he could. Pipe sat in silence in the apartment, lacerated by grief. His mother was his anchor, the only person who really understood him, and indeed the only person he could ever really trust. He had no one now. After an hour or so, he grabbed his gun, stormed out of the apartment past his grieving father, leapt down the stairs, and ran out into the projects. He spotted an associate named Jasper selling on the block in breach of sex money murder rules. Pipe marched up to him with a gun in his hand. "Who you hustling for?" Jasper gave him the name of some guy Pipe didn't know. Pipe demanded all his money, and Jasper complied. The next few days, Pipe felt like he was living underwater. He turned to Pete. He would allow only Pete to see just how weak and helpless he felt. Any others might see the softness and exploit it. When Pete heard that Pipe didn't have enough money to pay for funeral expenses and clothes for his mother to be buried in, he handed Pipe $1,200. The wake was at a funeral home on East 153rd Street and Cortland Avenue near the Melrose Projects. Pipe waited in line with his siblings, but in the end, he saw his mother in repose, her face an etiolated mask that couldn't reflect her joy, humor, and indefatigable spirit, and her special bond with Pipe. Her dimples were gone. He wanted to kiss her goodbye, but he couldn't bring himself to, because he refused to accept that this was her, and that her soul had moved on. One of Pipe's cousins, a Baptist preacher, got up to deliver an address. As he spoke about Miss Annette's life, Pipe rose, turned on his heel, and stormed outside. Roe and the others went to the burial out in New Jersey. They didn't have the money for a tombstone. With his mother gone, Pipe decided not to return to Buffalo. But there was another reason. A few months earlier, he had been forced to retreat from the city. A local crew had sent a female decoy posing as a customer, then rushed in behind her and ransacked his crack house at gunpoint. They beat Pipe up badly, knocking him out and leaving him in a pool of his own blood after smashing him over the head with the marble base of a sports trophy before they made off with all the drugs. "Niggas gonna run up in the crib, busting their joints?" Pipe had complained as one of Ladu's drug mules, who also worked as a nurse, stitched up his scalp. In the days following, Pipe looked at photos of local gang leaders that a friend of Ladu's, a pimp, had produced in the hope Pipe might identify his assailant. A week later, Pipe ambushed the man leaving a club at 1 a.m. "Sup, player?" spat Pipe, emerging from the shadows, raising a gun. "You remember me, right?" Pipe shot several rounds at his chest and the man collapsed on the ground. But hours later they heard he had survived and the bullets had either missed or were deflected by a bulletproof vest. Pipe knew a revenge cycle would start, disrupting his money flow, so he decided to return to Soundview and to look for other opportunities. Back home, he once again took over caring for the family. He made dinner for everyone before he swaddled three-month-old Ashley, fed her a bottle, and lulled her to sleep with his heartbeat as she lay on his chest. Once she was down, he headed to Cozy Corner. The family needed money to survive, and Pipe had no idea how to negotiate a welfare claim. Since the money in Buffalo had dried up, he had no choice but to start at the bottom of the game in Soundview again. He was still seen as the baby of sex, money, murder, and as such, he had to make his own way. He borrowed all the money he could from friends, invested in a major crack consignment, and often sold from 7 p.m. until sunrise. He paid his creditors and pocketed whatever he made, which went back into providing for the family. His mother's best friend, Psyche, had an apartment at 1725 Randall Avenue that Pipe called the dungeon because she kept it completely dark with blackout drapes. Pipe rented the apartment as a place to store his stash and keep his pit bulls. One day he returned to find Psyche complaining that one of the dogs had gone berserk, smashing itself against the walls and the door. Pipe found Yayo laid out beneath posters of Scarface and Tupac, barely breathing. To Pipe's dismay, the dog had eaten 7 grams of pure cocaine, his entire stash. Hours later, Yayo came too, suffering withdrawal, but alive. When Pete turned 18 in October 1992, he arrived in Soundview sporting a Rolex, which he showed off to Pipe. He told him that his father had left him the watch, a fur coat, and around $250,000 as a coming-of-age gift that his uncle George G.W. Wallace had now turned over to him. A year and a half earlier, in May 1991, Pete's mother had moved her 17-year-old son out of her apartment to live with Wallace in Queens. She hoped that an older man might straighten him out. But it became obvious to Pipe that, rather than straightening him out, Wallace had been acting as a mentor to his nephew in the drug game. Wallace was a suave and soft-spoken gangster from the old school who never raised his voice and had, as rumor went, been mentored by Pete's dad. Always perfectly attired, he was chiseled from the gym and eschewed drinking, smoking, and red meat, dietary restrictions that Pete had started to live by, too. Pete told Pipe of his plans to quadruple the $250,000 to $1 million. "We're going to be flipping bricks," he said, indicating that he now had a down payment on several kilos of cocaine that could be turned to profit. Pete and Pipe continued to search for cities where they could open crack franchises.
They ventured down to Baltimore and made just 2 hand-to-hand sales on Pulaski before a rival dealer spotted them on his turf and pulled a .45. During a scuffle over the weapon, Pete ran off and abandoned Pipe, only to think twice and return with a pistol before the man escaped. They shot the man's car up that night but decided to return to Soundview to continue the search for softer cities easier to conquer. BMO had established sex money murder in Kingston, New York, where there had been no resistance. He'd recruited youngsters with free bicycles and candy while intimidating any rivals with violence. Kingston had quickly earned a reputation as a place for hustlers to flip a small stake, an ounce or so, and double their money. Pete and Pipe arrived and found an easy place to prosper and sold out quickly. Pipe had been amassing a supply of Pete's crack at home so he could re-up as needed. He called Rowe at the apartment where $500 worth sat secured in a lockbox, telling him to hand it to an associate who would courier it up to Kingston for him. Rowe called back to say that the drugs were missing. Pipe panicked as he and Pete drove back to Soundview, but he kept quiet, brooding in the passenger seat, keeping the news to himself lest he incur Pete's rage. Pipe knew exactly who the culprit was. Big Bimbo could not recover from Annette's death. Pipe had noticed his father slowly unraveling as they both labored to keep the family together. He bought groceries with the money Pipe gave him, but more and more often Pipe noticed that he came up short with change. And now he was developing the loose-limbed swagger and roomy-eyed look of someone who had been on crack. Pipe confronted him on his return. Big Bimbo confessed. He offered to repay his son when he got his welfare check, but Pipe knew he couldn't afford to. Pipe peeled off some bills from the Kingston profits to pay for groceries. Then he headed out the door to work. Before he left, he told his father, "And when I get back, I'll get you something to get high with." Pipe figured it was absurd for his father to be buying crack from his competitors and lining the pockets of enemies. A few weeks later, Pipe and some friends, along with 2 young Hispanic women he had designs on, were playing music and lying low in an apartment in Soundview they used to store drugs. They heard a knock. One of the girls went to the door and returned to tell Pipe that his father wanted to discuss something with his son. Pipe found him on the threshold, overtaken by tremors. Pipe went to a back room and weighed out 5 grams, $200 worth, of some of the smoothest crack he had yet made. He came back to the door and handed it to his father. "Thank you, baby boy," said Big Bimbo, who grinned and withdrew. Sex Money Murder secured allegiance in the projects by demonstrating their generosity and by giving the appearance of community involvement. Sometimes they helped carry groceries for old people. They tossed a few dollars to kids on Cozy Corner. Rumors reached Pete and Pipe that a couple of crackheads were robbing the elderly. The boys found a bedraggled couple in their late 30s holed up in a first-floor apartment. The owner leased the space to crackheads for a little product herself. Pipe struck the man over the head with his revolver before loading a single bullet and enacting another game of Russian roulette. He asked the couple if one of them wanted to play. Spinning the cylinder, he put the gun to the man's head and pulled the trigger. The hammer came down on an empty chamber. Then he put the gun to his own temple and did the same. The gun clicked empty a second time. "See, you can't be scared to die," he said to the crackheads. The next chamber had a live round in it. "Don't play games with me, man. I don't have it. I'm not all right up here, you know what I'm saying? The streets done took over my mind." The outburst left him exhausted. They left the apartment. Pete was horrified. "What the fuck?" he said. "Are you fucking crazy?" Pipe trudged forward glumly. His mother's death had caused him to think about mortality on a deeper level. He found himself attempting to quash any sentimentality as a way to fortify himself. Once he'd dreamed of a middle-class future. Now he was in a life where moral limits were a vulnerability that got you killed. Other residents of the Soundview community tried to fight back against drug dealers. The Reverend Michael Tyson of Holy Cross Church had begun calling attention to the epidemic's devastation. Father Tyson had spent several years in the barrios of Puerto Rico, but nothing could have prepared him for Soundview. The day he arrived, he found that the priest he was taking over from was cleaning blood off the sidewalk from the previous night's dance at Holy Cross School. One man had been caught dancing with another man's wife, and the night had ended in gunfire. Another priest in the rectory had been beaten and robbed, answering a sick call. Father Tyson and a youth group organized a march against the dealers, despite police warnings. Death threats were called into the rectory. The police suggested that Father Tyson cancel. He refused. The commander of the 43rd Precinct lent him a bulletproof vest. Cops were stationed on the roofs of the Soundview houses. The priest and the parishioners marched around the horseshoe as drug dealers kept to the shadows or in the building's lobbies. They held an afternoon vigil outside a crack house at Commonwealth and Soundview, praying for the afflicted inside and for the darkness to go away. In early November, the youth group planned another march. This time the drug dealers exacted their revenge. They broke into the sacristy and smashed a 100-year-old statue of the Blessed Virgin. Then they set 4 separate fires in the church. The fires were contained. Father Tyson and the youth group marched in defiance. Alone in the hospital room when he came to, Shug found that he was able to move an arm, point his toes, and feel the soft restraint of sheets. His eyes opened and the darkness dissolved, and then panic came on. He couldn't breathe. He reached up to discover a long plastic pipe down his throat. His hand went down to his penis, where he felt a catheter. A nurse appeared at his bedside. He'd been in the intensive care unit for 5 days, she told him. She returned with a sedative injection. A doctor told him that the gunshots had severely damaged a lung and that he would have to walk with a cane for a few weeks. He had barely digested the news when a pair of detectives visited. Shug refused to answer any questions. They said they were working up warrants for his arrest on a litany of charges. He discharged himself as soon as he could and returned to Soundview for a few months. Pipe and everyone else warned him against going back to Springfield. Pete told him that he was being used by Baby J, that he would continue to be exploited while his partner sat back and counted his money. But nothing could convince him to stay away. Lured by the cash and the friends he had made, he was back in Springfield by December 1992. Shortly after his return, he and Baby counted out so many bills in one of Baby's houses that their hands turned black with grime. After an hour or so, they had tens of thousands of dollars in neat oblong stacks. Shug had never seen so much money. Baby thanked him for his work in protecting him. Grandly, he peeled off $10,000 and handed it to him. Shug fought the urge to say that it didn't seem like much for what he had done for Baby. He'd been shot twice protecting Baby's territory. Baby had sold over 60 kilos, netting more than $200,000 in the 2 years or so since he had arrived in the city. But he'd been arrested early in 1992 with 12 grams of cocaine. He skipped bail and fled Springfield. Occasionally, he returned to bring kilos to Shug or other dealers, but his visits grew rarer. This last time counting money with Shug marked his final visit to the city. He urged Shug to come with him to a new place he had in Virginia. Shug refused. Instead, he blew the money on women and partying. A few weeks later, Shug was arrested on possession of a firearm. The authorities prosecuted him with full force. In January 1993, he found himself in court facing a host of weapons and drug distribution charges. He pleaded guilty on April 16th and was sentenced to a maximum term of 4 to 7 years at the Massachusetts Correctional Institution, Cedar Junction, a prison southwest of Boston that had housed everyone from terrorists to Boston gangsters. Shug complained that he was being snatched off the street just as the real money was beginning to flow. Processed and led to the block, Shug saw other inmates he recognized as rivals from Springfield. "Hey, Shaft," one of the prisoners said to him, "there ain't no guns in here. What you going to do now, huh?" 5. Money Bath. By early 1993, Pete had become obsessed with turning sex money murder from a neighborhood crew into a syndicate capable of generating millions of dollars from crack, quite unlike the other local drug-dealing gangs. Sex money murder dominated Soundview, while across the Bronx, gangs proliferated. To the southwest over the Bronx River in Hunts Point were the Bryant Boys and Nasty Boys. To the east in the Frog's Neck Projects was the Dewey Avenue crew. To the north were the Albanian Boys in Morris Park and the Edenwald Boys from the notoriously dangerous Edenwald houses. Pete's ambition for sex money murder would require major connections to supply them with kilos and expanding markets, the conquest of drug markets in other cities and states, and the establishment of pipelines. So far, his lack of knowledge of large-scale trafficking had frustrated these audacious moves. In the first few months of 1993, sex money murder consisted of little more than eight main players in a loose pyramidal structure on which Pete sat atop, with Twin as his chief lieutenant. At 15, Pipe was the youngest of the group, one tier lower. Under them were one or two other neighborhood gangsters whose expertise ran to violence or making money from selling crack, the two primary methods of advancing in the organization. Anthony Big Ant Hardy acted as Pete's bodyguard, and Andre Dula Martin, a sex money murder associate from Castle Hill, played a supporting role. There was a growing band of associates who hustled product or eyed promotion through putting in work, slang for acts of violence. Pete drove around in his Volkswagen Golf, supplying Pipe and others with the odd kilo of cocaine. Pipe took the kilo up to the seventh floor of 1715 Randall, where it was cooked up. Next, he went to a bodega on Southern Boulevard and bought miniature blue Ziploc bags known as 12x12s. Together, a few members of the crew bagged it all up into nickels and passed it out to half a dozen hustlers who sold around the projects. Pipe worked a 60-40 split in his favor. The total from a kilo generally yielded $15,000, of which he took around $9,000. Pipe sold exclusively in Soundview. Another young dealer linked with the crew sold in Stevenson Commons. Twin controlled one of the Castle Hill Towers at 535 Havemeyer Avenue, but was looking to dominate all of the projects there. The product also made its way up into Kingston, largely controlled by BMO, Twin, and Pipe's brother Roe, now a member of the crew. A small setback occurred when Pete was arrested in Kingston on April 15th at 81 Prospect Street, the hub of sex money murder's activities, and charged with possession. His sentence was 30 days in the Ulster County Jail. Once freed, he never returned to Kingston. Instead, he delegated his operations in the city to Twin and decided to refocus his energies on New York City. The kilos Pete sold to Pipe came through connections he made through his Uncle George Wallace, but they came sporadically, sometimes only every 2 weeks and sometimes separated by as much as 2 months. Pipe sometimes had to go to Washington Heights to buy more on his own. But in the summer of 1993, sex money murder experienced a quantum leap in productivity with the appearance of Savon Codd, a trafficker with a long, thin, doleful face and a dead-eyed stare. Some called him Big Head. He came from the Sack Wern houses and had pioneered a pipeline into Pittsburgh that was netting him a small fortune. Earlier, he had allied with Baby J to make money in Springfield, but the two had fallen out. Codd had a growing reputation in Soundview as a rainmaker who could set you back up in the drug business when you were penniless on release from prison. Codd, whose mother had been held at gunpoint in her house while $40,000 of his money was stolen, needed protection and a gunbuster like Pete. And Pete, for his part, needed more product. The two were made for each other. Pete began to accompany Codd to Pittsburgh on drug runs around May or June. He was paid $3,000 to $5,000 just to ride shotgun on deliveries of 8 to 10 kilos. Shortly thereafter, Pete brought Codd into sex money murder as a ranking lieutenant. Codd showed Pete how a multi-state drug trafficking organization worked.
He bought a kilo in New York for $18,000, but sold it in Pittsburgh for $46,000, a quick profit of $28,000. Key to Codd's operation was his sophistication in moving large amounts of drugs in a fleet of cars. In Pittsburgh, he leased vehicles at Three Rivers Leasing, paying cash for them at inflated prices. They came with paperwork that Codd could show to the police, who might be curious why 18-year-olds were driving around in extravagant cars. None of the drug dealers' names were on the papers. Codd even suggested incorporating so that they could lease cars in the name of a corporate entity. Codd's cunning was felt immediately on the block. He arranged for Pipe to get a driver's license through a corrupt connection in New Jersey. For $500, Codd had a man take the driving test using Pipe's name. Afterward, Pipe went into the DMV with the paperwork and had his picture taken for the new license. And when Pete pulled up on the block in an old two-door Cutlass Sierra, Pipe saw a modification to the car that illustrated Codd's sophistication. "Watch this," Pete said. He pressed buttons on the dashboard, and the glove compartment popped open to reveal a secret box containing a .38 revolver. "That's a stash box," he declared proudly. Others called the hiding places traps. "Police ain't know nothing about that." Codd maintained an apartment on Jerome Avenue in the Bronx, a street known to the DEA as a place Dominican crews, master craftsmen of stash boxes, plied their trade. The bond between Codd and Pete evolved. Secure now that he was under the aegis of Pistol Pete and Sex Money Murder, Codd flaunted gold jewelry and a Glock pistol. He brought in new members who were flashy and moneyed, driving expensive cars. NSX Mike was so-called because he took Pete out for a ride in his new Honda NSX, crashed it, and returned the next day with a brand new one. Crucially, Codd made a key introduction that would fuel Sex Money Murder's ascent. John Castro, a Dominican who had links to Colombian drug cartels through friends in Washington Heights, gave Pete access to multiple kilos whenever he needed them. Tall, brawny, and debonair, Castro was dark enough to pass as both Hispanic and African American. He had been educated at an all-male Catholic school and served in the Air Force before working as a corrections officer in the Bronx House of Detention. Now he ran a clothing store on 145th Street, while also supplying drugs to Sex Money Murder and other crews across the city. He practiced Santeria, and as his business partnership with Pete strengthened, he lured Pete into the religion. Pete viewed Castro as a role model. Women clung to him, and he made the drug trade look fashionable. Castro sold Pete kilos, and Pete in turn supplied Pipe with 2 to 3 kilos any time he requested them, while also supplying out-of-town operations. The profits grew into the tens of thousands. Pete set himself up in an apartment in the upper-middle-class neighborhood of Riverdale in the Bronx, about 9 miles northwest of Soundview. He now had a Rolodex of drug connections like no other Bronx gang leader. One evening, Pipe was standing on the block with Pete when he made out a row of multicolored beads laced around Pete's neck, softly agleam in the dusky light thrown by a street lamp. Pete explained that the beads had been blessed and that it was bad luck for anyone to touch them. Green symbolized the Orisha Ogun, a warrior deity who granted victory to his devotees. Inspired by Pete's messianic status, young hustlers and sex money murder wannabes began wearing Santeria beads. As Santeria spread through the growing Hispanic communities of Harlem and the Bronx following its arrival in the city in the 1940s, police began to notice carcasses of headless goats and chickens at the foot of makeshift altars, dripping with wax candles, in places like Pelham Bay Park. The religion was born among Yoruba slaves, largely from Nigeria, brought to work in the sugar plantations in Cuba. Forbidden to practice their traditional religions, they concealed their faith amid the trappings of Roman Catholicism. For example, they prayed to St. Barbara, who represented Shango, the god of thunder and lightning, whose father was struck by lightning when he beheaded her. One evening, Pete took Pipe for a ride up to a Santeria botanica near Fort Apache. The small storefront offered few clues that it was a center for Santeria practitioners, but as Pipe followed Pete inside, the peppery aroma of angelica herbs settled on his skin and clothes. Pipe shivered as demonic-looking faces hovered in the half-light. Pete spoke with easy familiarity to Raoul, a white-haired man who stood behind the counter, dressed in a Hawaiian shirt.
"You ready?" he asked Pete. "It's all set up in the back."
He led Pete and Pipe through heavy velvet curtains to a back room where Raoul's 16-year-old niece greeted them. An old Victorian bathtub, full of dollar bills, sat on steel legs in the middle of the room. Chickens clucked in a small cage against a back wall. Pipe thought about making a break for it.
"Hell no," he blurted to Pete. "This is some hoodoo shit, man."
Pete was calm.
"I think I'ma do it."
"You going to do what?"
"I'ma take the money bath."
"I don't know about that shit, Mo."
"What about your friend?" asked Raoul. "Is he going to do it, too?"
Pete didn't pause.
"Yeah, that's my little brother. He's doing it. But I'm going first."
The man told the boys to strip down to their boxers. Pete undressed, handing Pipe his gun. Pete stepped into the tub and reclined. Raoul lit candles and some incense and then launched into deep-throated incantations in Spanish. He wafted smoke over Pete's body. Next, he broke an egg over him, and Pipe saw that the yolk was filled with blood. Raoul trailed the bloody liquid over Pete's chest. Next, Raoul gestured to his niece, who took a chicken out of a cage. The bird squawked and struggled before Raoul expertly sliced its neck. He dribbled the blood up and down Pete's body. Throughout, Pete lay still as if he were soaking in the bathtub before a Saturday night out. The man produced another egg, which he broke over Pete. This time the egg was bloodless. The raw yolk dribbled down the side of his face. 5 minutes later, the ritual came to a close when Raoul told Pete to get to his feet. He declared that whatever Pete was trying to do, he would accomplish it. "You're going to get money," he said, "and all the things you want. But there are going to be consequences. Either of two things will happen. You're going to get killed, or you're going to jail for the rest of your life." Pete showed no emotion. Pipe, his pulse hammering a tattoo, handed the guns to Pete and climbed into the bath, settling amid the blood-soaked bills. When Raoul wafted smoke over him, Pipe flinched. Pete, sprawled on a nearby chair, burst into giggles.
"You're supposed to be a gangster, and you all nervous."
Pete told him to relax.
"What you scared of?"
Pipe declared, with as much bluster as he could, that he wasn't frightened. He screwed his eyes shut and thought of something else, anything, to take his mind off this. He thought of piles of money. The cold, viscous yolk of an egg rolled down his face. He started to shake. Minutes later, he heard the loose, canvas-like slap of beating feathers, a muffled caw, and then silence, followed by what he knew was the warm blood of the chicken trickling over his eyelids. Afterward, Raoul showed them to a small shower next door. Pete cleaned up first, but before he did so, he peeled off a few hundreds from the $10,000 roll in his pocket. Pipe offered to help pay.
"Don't worry about it," Pete said. "I'm going to get it back 10 times.
At 10 o'clock on a Sunday night in the summer of 1993, Pete and the crew rolled over potholes and pulled up next to the fractured sidewalks outside 551 in a fleet of buffed new cars, music blaring as they readied to head into Manhattan. Pete drove Cod's Toyota Supra. B-Love sat at the wheel of a K5 Blazer. Sex, money, murder swooped across the Bronx in this shimmering convoy and entered Manhattan by the George Washington Bridge, then sped down the West Side Highway on their way to a club in Chelsea. The crew drove to the fabled Tunnel nightclub on 12th Avenue. On most nights, the club was given over to a fin de siècle hedonism where androgynous club kids and transgender disco queens filled the dance floors. Almost the whole crowd was white. The Tunnel's owner, Peter Gation, saw Sunday as a dead, loss-leading night,
but he also saw that rap was going mainstream, so he had given the night over to hip-hop, a night he called Mecca. Within months, thousands of black kids descended on the club, backing up the blocks in every direction. Barricades lined the sides of the big Chelsea warehouses. The Manhattan club scene had rigorous protocols on who was in and who was out. Pete had been courting Puff Daddy, who in 1993 founded the label Bad Boy Records. The promoter had put